Thanks for inviting me, especially since I have a somewhat different background than most of you here. I just want to kind of highlight what that is to frame the rest of the conversation and the perspectives I'm bringing. So I did my PhD in the Econ CS group at Harvard, which is kind of the intersection of computer science and economics. I did 3 internships at Microsoft Research. Microsoft Research is kind of a private university run by Microsoft where there are no students, no funding issues, no administrative tasks. So it's kind of like Perimeter, I guess, but for computer science. I actually did a postdoc there in computational social science. So throughout these areas, I got exposed to AI, human-computer interaction, and then more work that looked like social science with computational elements, experimental econ, and so on. I did a brief stint, very brief, as a tenure-track faculty in Aarhus University in Denmark, working with both the business school and Science at Home, which is a citizen science group that developed this, is well known for this game called Quantum Moves. So they're like quantum physicists turned citizen scientists and software engineers. But as you can see, I've kind of like straddled the wall between academia and industry for far too long, so I finally jumped off and went to work at a startup. So this is kind of the path that I've taken, and I think it gives me a good position to talk about when I'm doing research, looking at how research is done both in companies and in the academy. So I'm going to try and make 2 provocations, 2 points here today. The first is that there's a lot of important research under the domain of private companies that won't actually get done, even though it's important to society. And the second, maybe recycling some of Arfon's points earlier, is it's almost impossible to produce open source software in academia. So I'm going to kind of highlight these 2 and come back to maybe a little counterexample at the end. So the first point, kind of the type of research that can be done at companies. I think this is particularly pertinent in computer science and computational social science. Companies like Facebook and Google have access to much more behavioral data about people and much more computational resources than are available at universities. And this lets them do things that you can't really do without being able to access and process data sets of this size. So I'm talking about things like data center research in computer systems, large-scale machine learning when you need lots of data, and computational social science when you're looking at large numbers of people. In many of these areas in computer science and related fields, you can't really do the cutting-edge research without having access to all this data and being able to process it. So a couple of examples of that. There was this 61 million person experiment on Facebook in voter turnout where they showed that they basically could increase the number of people that voted based on showing something that their friends did. Actually, you can't do an experiment of that size without having access to Facebook. There are things like Google's Bigtable. This is actually a paper that was written over 10 years ago. It kind of forms the basis of Apache Spark now. But this is also something you can't do unless you have a giant distributed computing system and you're actually designing something to take advantage of that. Almost impossible to build something like this in academia. So companies are able to do research that universities can't. And that's a good thing in the cases where these are actually published. But there's also examples of where that doesn't happen. So let me tell you an interesting story. Facebook has this group called Core Data Science. And the idea is that they are going to use the social data from Facebook to learn about how people interact with each other and the world around them. Right? So our findings directly inform decisions to improve people's everyday experiences on Facebook, make it easier and more intuitive to use, and find ways to facilitate meaningful social interactions. Research efforts span a large variety of interdisciplinary topics and a bunch of different methods. We also build scalable platforms for the collection, management, and analysis of data. That includes open source software. And this is my kind of highlight here. Actively contribute our scientific findings to the academic research community. So for a while, Facebook's core data science group actually turned out a lot of interesting work that couldn't really be done anywhere else. And it's almost, I think it's important to actually study this because we want to know what effects giant platforms have like Facebook when they are changing the way that people interact and communicate with each other. But that all started to change when this happened. So I don't know if you guys remember this study, but it kind of caused quite a stir because it wasn't actually. So what they basically did in this experiment is they hid some things from certain people's news feeds, and found very tiny results in based on natural language processing, tiny effect sizes on how that changed what other people expressed. And then they put this really flashy title up, massive experiment, evidence of emotional contagion, and might have overblown the result a little bit, but it caused a huge uproar in the media. This also wasn't exactly reviewed by an IRB, so that kind of exacerbated the situation. The kinds of headlines that came out with this, Facebook manipulated users' news feeds to create emotional responses. Now, manipulation is something you use as an experimental term when you kind of test your treatment versus your control. It's something you apply to your treatment condition. But when you see the word manipulation printed in popular media, the connotation is that you're doing something bad, right? The end result of this experiment and the bad publicity that it generated for Facebook is that Facebook didn't want people to publish anymore. Like for its researchers, right, it's risky to publish findings about Facebook. What if you create bad publicity like this? I know many colleagues that are in core data science at Facebook. After this came out, much harder to get things cleared for publication. Right, even like all these studies that we think are important about the social network. Disclosing things like this that power has the Facebook to do is actually bad for business. Right, it creates business risks for Facebook to actually do this kind of open research. So then we keep going. There's less kind of data science and computational science work coming out of Facebook. And then you see stuff like this, right? The most recent Cambridge Analytica scandal is also worse for Facebook optics, and it kind of shows that they have not committed to transparency about their platform, and instead have actually gone to pretty far lengths to stop kind of bad optics from getting out. And, you know, this scandal is important because it might actually open the door to finally having more transparency about Facebook. Because we see that there are kind of political concerns in addition to research concerns about the power that Facebook has with its user data. And just to highlight kind of what this kind of lack of disclosure is like at Facebook, Alex Stamos was the chief security officer at Facebook who had basically wanted more disclosure over the types of data that Facebook was releasing about its users or leaking about its users. But as he advocated for more disclosure, he basically got reassigned a different job and eventually decided to leave. Right. So these are kinds of the business risks that are possible when we have a platform like Facebook that has the potential to do so much research, but is not in the interest of the company. Now, so that's what I want to argue here. And the first point is that Facebook is one of the largest socio-technical systems we've built. It connects people together in different ways. It makes you compare yourself against your friends constantly. It kind of changes how you communicate with people. And yet, that research, which is probably one of the most important things that we should be able to do in large-scale social science and haven't even been able to do before, might not actually see the light of day because of the corporate interests of the company. So I think that's a huge challenge for open research and what we can accomplish. The fact that these companies have a lot of interests that are entrenched, and they also have research that no one else can do elsewhere. How do we actually get there, right? So, there are many examples you can come up with this, like the sharing economy, Uber, Airbnb, other platforms, right? Is this actually, as an economist, you've probably studied this, Babu, but like, or thought about this, but the effects of pricing in the sharing economy, is it actually freeing people to use their time however they want? And letting them produce different services for others? Or is it actually enslaving them into low-paying, insecure jobs, right? We need to do research about that, but if it creates bad optics for the company, it's really hard to get those collaborations going. So nobody disputes any of that? Okay.
But at the same time, I mean, there's all this discussion about, like, on like, Super Freakonomics on NPR, they have this discussion of, like, how Uber, for instance, is so wonderful both for the drivers and for the customers. That's why the market is so inelastic, that there is that the Uber actually extracting so little value compared to the amount of value that the users are extracting. So I mean, it's not like, I mean, there's no good and bad, right? I mean, it's much more complex.
Yeah, but I mean, my point is that, like, it requires transparency to do research to answer those questions. And it's hard to get companies to kind of open up with their data to actually do that.
Like Uber at least, so researchers from outside the company itself are able to access the data and do analysis, like on this search pricing and so on and so forth. So, I mean, maybe for them it's not as critical as for Facebook to keep the data away from the researchers, but
yeah,
at least in that case, it does seem to be working to some extent. I mean, there is some sort of cross-pollination.
Okay, I didn't know about that. I should chat more. Yeah.
Of course, there have been industries on the internet that basically had access to unique data, and it was difficult to properly incentivize them. So, like, finance is something where there's a lot of really sophisticated research going on. They publish internal research papers, basically, that are considered basically proprietary.
Yeah.
And I agree, like, the more ways we could open it up, the better. But it also seems to me like some of these are just, like, long-standing, intractable, like, how do you possibly compensate a finance company that could use this secret to make millions of dollars a year? Like,
yeah,
for Facebook.
Yeah.
Why would a company open its book?
Yeah, so I agree it's, like, a good thing to think about. What could we do? What's a reasonable way where we could incentivize it and, like, find a positive something, create more information, maybe the company gets compensated or something. But I could also just imagine it being, there's no way to do this problem. Like, it's just, we're stuck on it.
I mean, I guess that's kind of the, throw your arms up response to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is Facebook's business model is to make money off of our data, so we can't do anything about that. I don't know. I feel like there's some kind of moral, maybe ethical imperative to do research on platforms like Facebook and understand how they affect people and the power that they have, right? So that's all I'm saying.
So I'm just going to throw this out here. I think you're in some sense asking for suggestions about this problem. We knew how we solved this in the case of the government. We had Edward Snowden, right? Snowden leaked it, and I wonder if people within these systems will eventually leak this data.
Maybe.
I mean,
yeah.
It's an illegal action, obviously. But given that Facebook is probably the most powerful institution in the supposedly democratic system, at some point in time, I hope that somebody will leak this data.
All right, let me go on, because I have a kind of a discussion period at the end where I kind of bring this all together. I want to kind of talk about the other example, if you don't have any more specific questions. So the other example I want to give is kind of the difference between open source software at companies and in the university. So if you were around in the 90s when I was a kid, we referred to Microsoft as the evil empire, right? It was a really closed system, and in addition to kind of anti-competitive behavior, they also had a really proprietary ecosystem, right? You would have to kind of agree to these license agreements whenever you installed software. You would be prone to kind of open to lawsuits if you didn't. I think this is kind of encapsulated by, this famous phrase that Steve Ballmer said. He really did not like copyleft, right? Microsoft had a really severe kind of not invented here syndrome. They didn't use open source at all. They didn't want to attach anything that was related to open source because it might contaminate their IP. In fact, one of the most famous examples I can hear of is they didn't actually use their own version control system. So they pushed the product for version control that other people use. It's like a really crappy version of Git. But they didn't actually use that in-house. They used something else that was came from another vendor. Right? So they wanted everything to be owned by them and made by them and not contaminated by everything else. But if you've been paying attention to like what's happened recently, basically hell has frozen over, right? For us that grew up in the 90s and saw Microsoft take over this kind of practice, right? We have kind of, they're open sourcing their C# compilers, their .NET compilers. There's people on Hacker News effectively saying like, this is crazy, how is this possible? There's many, many threads that you can find about this, right? But basically, Microsoft has embraced open source, and people were really, really skeptical of their open sourcing stuff, like, what's their ulterior motive here? Why are they doing this? Why are they releasing all their software? If you look at Microsoft's GitHub page, right, they have 1,700 open source repositories with 3,700 employees, maybe about 10% of the total actually actively engaged there. And that's crazy. That's a crazy turnaround and for a company that basically did not believe in sharing anything at all. And I think Arfan has spoken a little bit about this, but you know, GitHub has basically won this open source war. It's kicked out Google Code, which was Google's approach to doing this. It's beat out SourceForge. So many open source projects, both by individuals and large companies, are now hosted on GitHub. Microsoft, Google, and Facebook all contribute significantly to open source. And GitHub is the standard. And one of the, I think, really strong reasons why this came about is explained by kind of the guy that publicizes open source software at Facebook. Like, Facebook sees open source as being good for business. It means we build better software, write better code, our engineers are able to work with more pride, and we're able to retain the world's best engineers because they know they can contribute to open source. Ultimately, engineers can see for themselves the kinds of things that Facebook is working on, and it makes it easier to attract the top talent. So I think companies have kind of come to this consensus that with certain types of open source software, maybe that's, you know, not core to your business, getting it out there actually encourages the attraction of talent, leads to better quality work because you're actually building things that other people have to use, and kind of stimulates another lever of motivation for engineers other than money, right? So that actually works really well in industry right now, and that's why you see a lot of companies, even certain startups, releasing open source software right from when they've actually just begun. The situation is not quite the same in academia, I think. We've talked quite a bit about how academics aren't great software engineers. I kind of like found this interesting thread on Academia Stack Exchange. Why are all these people I'm working with in academia bad at writing software? It's something that doesn't necessarily overlap with the research skill set. And as Arfan said, it requires a lot of effort to both do good research and write good code. You can't just expect someone to be a top-level researcher and produce top-quality software. Because writing software well that other people can use is really hard. I think one of my favorite ways to think about this comes from this book, Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering, and it's called The Rule of Three. It's three times as difficult to build reusable components as single-use components, and a reusable component has to be tried out three different places before it actually is going to be general enough to use in the library. And then I just tacked this on myself because there might as well be three rules. Why do they only have two? I think it's three times as hard to document software product than to just write the code for it. So now if you think about this, it's making open source software as an academic isn't just an issue of release your code. If you actually want to release your code in a way that it's useful in other situations and people can understand what it does, now you're looking at an order of magnitude more work. And that trade-off, right, makes it much harder to make it worth your while. We've also talked a little bit this morning about how software doesn't give you citations. I think one of the great examples of this is R packages, and specifically the work of Hadley Wickham. Right, he made this package for R called ggplot2 over 10 years ago, and he's made a lot of contributions to R since then. But he's actually, at that point, I think he was a professor at Rice University, but he's actually left. Because these contributions he was making to R weren't actually recognized in academia. And this is kind of some fuel to add to the fire of our discussion this morning. There are definitely some academic statisticians who just don't understand why what I do is statistics, but basically I think they're all wrong. What I do is fundamentally statistics. The fact that data science exists as a field is a colossal failure of statistics. To me, that's what statistics is all about. It's about gaining insight from data using modeling and visualization. Data munging and manipulation is hard, and statistics has just said, that's not our domain. Right. I think like when the field of computational social science was coalescing, I was also wondering why aren't statisticians, you know, participating in this? Right. They're kind of interested in estimators and all these theoretical properties of stuff, but not actually practical problems that you might want to solve with statistics. So you know, like we had this discussion before: is this research? Is this not research? Is the process of using methods to get to results actually research? By the way, this is Hadley Wickham's kind of profile on our documentation, which keeps track of the impact of people that they've had on R by R packages. He's in the 100th percentile, and his software has 27,000 downloads per month. Right. So this is not. This is. You could say that's a far bigger impact than he could have had, maybe even by writing statistics papers.
Like 3 orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
Would you say that writing a textbook is proper academic behavior in the sense that it's recognized or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is recognized, right? So if you can write a textbook, why can't you write software? I'm just going to give one example from my own experience. So during my meandering path through research, one of the things I try to do is build software to take these behavioral labs from kind of psychology and behavioral econ and bring them on the internet. So the idea is we take these people, we put them in a room, we give them some stimuli and measure things about them. That's really limited in how long we can keep those people there, the size of the group we can study, the amount of data we can instrument. So I decided to build a web platform so that we could do this on the internet with bigger groups of people. Now the idea behind this, I thought I had a great idea, right? I would build an open source platform that made it easier to study groups of people in real time using all the latest and greatest web technologies. I could actually study groups of people. I could see all these things about what they were doing. And not only would I release this platform, I would release all my experiments as open source code as well. So now, not only are we just releasing code as open data, as we're now releasing open data, but I'm also releasing open source code. So you could see how I did the experiment, and you could just run that code again. If you had those people, you could plug them in and replicate the experiment, right? That was kind of the grand vision. This system was actually pretty cool. I can't show you all the things, but like this is kind of the real-time view of the back end when people are actually participating. So here I had people playing a two-player game. They were getting matched in random groups with each other. And you can actually basically see in real time all the people that are connected. When they finish a game, they'd go into this like waiting room and you know be matched into different groups. You can like kind of click on each of these groups to see what they're doing. So this is kind of combined everything I knew about distributed systems and like web programming with like social science experiments and all that. I thought it was going to be great. There's going to be a lot of people using it, right? Right? No. So the failure of this work is kind of exemplified by this XKCD comic. This software is still on GitHub, but ultimately, you know, it just landed in the pile of discarded academic software platforms, of which I can rattle off probably about 15 that do similar things. I mean, they don't do like real-time user interaction, but other that was kind of my unique contribution. So, in fact, the experimental econ software that's still most widely used these days is something called ZTree, and this is what the user interface looks like for that.
Nice.
Right. If this is an experiment you design in ZTree, it has a lot of buttons, a lot of numbers. I find it hard to believe actually that someone would actually be able to process and make decisions under this infrastructure, but economists swear by it because the guy that wrote the paper for this, as Arfon suggested, has, you know, 8,000 citations for it. So it's not just that building something better is necessarily going to win, right? Like I think the process of building software means not only has to be done well, but you have to publicize it. There's a lot of other factors that play into that. So building the proliferation of tools is a difficult one to kind of get credit for.
I love it that it says, please reach a decision.
Yeah, in very small red letters at the top right. So where are we at? I kind of made this point that there's essential research that companies probably won't do. academics probably can't build open source tools. But there's one area that I think I see some exceptions to these two rules. And if you guys aren't familiar with it, I kind of want to just give a few examples. So if you're not familiar with the kind of the field of machine learning and deep learning in particular, this is a really different area of research where all sorts of crazy things happen. What you're about to see may shock you. All right, so we have this, there are standard data sets in machine learning, first of all. So a common problem is image classification, computer vision. So someone came up with this, Fei-Fei Li and her group at Stanford came up with this thing called ImageNet, which has all these pictures sorted into 1,000 classes, and there's 1.2 million of them to train your algorithms on. So you take this, you take these images, you look at some of them, and you kind of learn what the labels are, and then you try and make some predictions. So this data set, the standard data set, allowed them to have these computer vision competitions every year, where results are benchmarked against this data set, and people can actually publish papers as they come up with methods to improve machine learning. So this is a computer vision challenge with ImageNet in 2015. In January 13 of 2015, Baidu submitted the first, one of the earliest papers that showed that they kind of beat a basic benchmark in this data set. Less than a month later, Microsoft showed that they were the first to beat human level performance on this data set. This was the first paper to actually achieve or beat human level performance on this data set. And sorry, forgot what I was going to say. These papers are all posted on Archive, right? So as soon as someone's kind of finished their work, they post the paper on Archive, and like everyone can see the results. Less than 5 days later, Google came along with another paper that beat the Microsoft paper and posted that on Archive. All these papers actually got published in machine learning conferences later, but it's kind of like we have a preprint, we just put it there, show our results, and this kind of iteration happens really quickly. So if you're in a field where you don't like getting scooped, or you think scooping is kind of something scary, you might not want to work in this kind of area, right? Because your results will get scooped constantly, even though you're doing different methods. The funny part of this story is that a couple months after that, Baidu got banned from the competition. Because they were actually cheating in this by, they created basically 100 different accounts and kind of cheated on the test set of this data. So they're using the server that validates your results to try and get some information about that. And they actually were prevented in contributing here for a year. So there's both like really fast iteration here and really crazy incentives that spurred unethical behavior. In deep learning also, everything is open source. So you have these companies, they support these common deep learning frameworks. Google has TensorFlow and Keras. Facebook has Caffe and PyTorch. PyTorch is used by their development, by their research team, and Caffe is used by the production team. So they're not even actually on the same framework. Microsoft has produced CNTK and so on. But all this stuff is open source. It's being supported by companies. In fact, there's quite a big revolving door between industry and companies. One of the professors that I knew at Harvard started a startup that, with five people, that around 1 year later was acquired by Twitter for their machine learning expertise. And killed, right? So this was an acqui-hire. They were like, oh, there are all these machine learning researchers. A little bit later, he went to Google, decided Twitter wasn't enough for him, and then a little bit later than that, got hired as a tenured professor at Princeton, and then you can see on the right side of his profile that he's currently on leave at Google Brain, right? So if you're a researcher in this field, like the top talent is constantly kind of walking between companies and universities. This phenomenon of acqui-hires is both interesting from a scientific perspective because the research has so much in common between both areas, but also a little bit scary because if you're a machine learning professor, you can basically start a group with some of your students and get paid like $2 million per person and then go do something else. I think machine learning has also raised some interesting methods for publication, right? So if you haven't heard of this journal called Distill, This is a journal that publishes web-based articles where pretty much all the figures are interactive. So the goal is to try and help you understand how algorithms work by visualizing their data. If you go to distill.pub, you can see kind of these papers. They all just work in your browser. So this is another way of kind of publishing information that doesn't require a static PDF-based format. And I think this journal is particularly interesting. Like if you're in the field of bioinformatics or something, these ideas are really interesting for how to present and display your data to other researchers. So the final thing I just want to end on is, like, I talked about these two things. How do we do open research on systems that are closed when the incentives are not there to make them transparent? And, you know, how can we take some of these ideas from the open source movement in industry, where it became gradually closed to more open, and or how it works in machine learning, and apply those to the software that we can build of value as academics? Thanks.
The remarks were controversial enough to spark some comments.
So isn't it true that, when all this Cambridge Analytica scandal came up, that so in fact there is an API that Facebook has provides to get at least some of the data out? And at least sort of it was part of the discussion that yes, we don't control like all the data that's been downloaded, and much of it is for academic purposes and so on.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I actually know a researcher that applied much of the same method to try and scrape the network of Facebook. Because Facebook doesn't give you that directly, but you can create a bunch of accounts and kind of like add people from those accounts and kind of crawl your friend's network to build that social network. So Facebook won't give you that network, but you can kind of use certain underhanded methods to obtain it. So I think people are in some sense taking that into their own hands. So they are trying to get at the Facebook social network in the same way that Cambridge Analytica did.
Can I just add something to
that? Pardon?
The API, I know some researchers who are using that API, and you can use it sort of for population level inference because it's a lot of aggregated data, but some of the most interesting applications of Facebook data requires individual data with some demographic information attached to it.
Yeah, so sorry, Simon, go ahead.
So I just wanted to bring up two things. One is, even when you have access to an API, the data is often not true. So the political scientists have been using Twitter a great deal. They have a reasonably open API. Researcher, Rebecca Trumbull, reverse engineered it. It's giving wildly incorrect results that are distorting the literature of political science. So there's a huge danger there. The interests of a company in providing that API and the interests of a researcher are not very well aligned. So there's a huge trust problem, I think, where a company doesn't have the same incentives to provide correct data. On the flip side, I wanted to give a positive story. So we just had a meeting on patents at the Senate Institute. Patents have worked extremely well to open innovation across competing companies. And I'm wondering if we wanted to think in a very long-term way, is there some way we can learn from the patent system to enable companies to open their data in the right kind of way?
So how does patenting allow companies to make companies feel like they can open their data?
So in terms of the method, how would patents work in this case? Is that what you're asking?
Or just in your specific case, like,
how patents work, or how patents could work in this?
How do patents reduce the perceived risk by companies to making their data transparent?
So patents don't do that right now, right? Patents are about patenting technologies as opposed to data.
Right.
So the reason they work with patent technologies is the better you describe the technology you invented, the better your legal claims against somebody who infringes will be. So there's an alignment there of incentives to get it right.
I mean, I think legally right now you can patent algorithms, but you can't patent data, right? That's basically,
right.
And yeah.
Data's not considered a creative work in
right.
The US, so it isn't subject to copyright.
Everybody's talking about Facebook and stuff. What about Google? I mean, they know much more about me. They have all my emails, all my
yeah.
Should They do searchers look at Google?
They
to see how it behaves and what ads are.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of took the juicy story so I could tell the story, but I think that's just as a big concern. I think there's a lot of debate right now about, like, everybody's piling onto Facebook, but, you know, people say Google is just as bad. They're just kind of doing a good job of hiding it right now. Yeah, did you have a comment?
I just want to highlight something that you say from a business point of view, that you are the acqui-hire for 2.5 million. Academia could do the same. I mean, a talented professor like Guy Rosie Simon, you are paid, let's say, 100 here, but I want you in my university, so I just buy you like a transfer, like in a sports player, because I'm sure that you will attract more students or more, I don't know, postdocs or whatever. It's an asset that you transfer in one way or other, so business is not necessarily the evil, it's just make it a little bit more acceptable.
That exists. That's how Perimeter was founded, pretty much.
Okay.
By offering really good salaries to studying faculty. That exists in academia as well.
Yeah, but this kind of money is abnormal in academia.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can do that in every field. That's right.
No. I mean, you mentioned it, the whole flavor of the month. I mean, the earning and that stuff. Yeah. So
I did not like the second sentence that you wrote. You said academia cannot produce open source software. And of course, I work in academia. I produce open source software.
Yeah.
So I didn't like that statement. So I'm wondering, why is no one else having my back here? Well, why are you all agreeing that what I do doesn't work?
Usually people who do what you do don't get hired in academia.
OK, that's true. I don't have a tenure track position.
Yeah, so. It's a very tiny set for people who have this skill and get hired in academia. So.
The common model in academia is you have a grad student do the code, they do it, and then they move on to another project, and the code is not maintained or something, which is different than what you do. You have a more long-term perspective on your work, I think.
Okay. So you're saying they do produce open source software, but after 5 years, it's a pile of crap, and high-quality open source software requires some other mechanism.
It requires maintenance. It requires documentation. If you just hire someone and they're learning to build software, as soon as they've kind of acquired decent software engineering skills, they've left and gone to do something else. So you're kind of getting software that's built by mostly trainees, right? That was the case for me too.
Probably the difference is that you do excellent software, but you do excellent software here and here. Who maintains that software? Who follows up? Who reproduces? You need a structure around that, so you are an isolated exception, but you don't have a community within the institution that can support you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the
studies writes the big open source software, for example, the Glue compiler, LLVM, Rust compiler, things like that. Is it mostly funded by companies or mostly universities?
Yeah, I think most of the large software is funded by companies that are basically paying someone, one or multiple people, a team of people, full time to work on that, right? And it's kind of like it gives the company more visibility. It gives those people, engineers, more interest. It attracts people because you see, like, that's the company that built LLVM, or that's a team. I want to join that team.
That's an interesting statement, because that means the use that the company has for these engineers, it's not directly to the bottom line. It's more indirect, right? Acquire high,
yeah,
a job talent or something. And one could make the same case in academia. If you want to have a good researcher, and this researcher happens to like to produce open source software, then you should hire him or her and allow him to produce software.
Sorry, just a quick comment. I think I feel like some labs have tried that, right? There's like a professor that has some software project they're interested in, and they're kind of the rolling pipeline of graduate students through there are contributors to that, right? I think that's worked in a few cases, but most professors aren't good like product managers, and most of the grad students aren't good software engineers, so there's a lot of ways that can go wrong. Sorry, yeah.
I mean, if we look at the history of this, all open source software emerged from the academy, right? Berkeley, MIT, right? So that's where it began, and incredibly sophisticated systems came out of that, right? So the joke is if you Google or if you search the source code for any product, you'll find BSD somewhere, Berkeley Systems Distribution.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what were the conditions under which that was possible, right? If anything, academia was more conservative back when this was happening. So what made it possible for academia to blow this open?
The 60s.
A lot of drugs.
A liberal approach. I mean,
a different norm culture.
What do you think, Arfon?
I was going to say proximity to industry, actually. I mean, I think Berkeley Labs still have a good... So certainly in the sort of data science tool chain, you still see them actively kind of taking a project from an academic phase to a, now let's give this to the Apache Software Foundation and turn this into a bigger sort of project. Because they've written their paper, they've made their academic contribution, they've proven the approach at some level, and now they're like, and now this is a community infrastructure thing. You still see that happening, actually. And I wonder if that's just this.
It's a handoff. I mean, there it seems like they've solved this problem by having a handoff.
Actually, I mean, Twitter, to be fair, do that with their own resource as well these days. I mean, it's one thing you didn't talk about, but there is a kind of a growing problem, is companies are interested in open source projects for as long as it's valuable to their business interests, right? And they might move on, right? So what happens when a project that was sustained by a company because people paid by the company were producing a lot of the value or leading that project, then go off and work on something else? So you can see a lot of Twitter's high profile open source work is now they give it to the Apache Software Foundation for exactly this reason. They say, we are not the right people to own this in the long term. Microsoft released a lot of their stuff under the .NET Foundation rather than, it's not Microsoft owned.
They have some influence in .NET, right?
But I mean, they've explicitly separated that from the core business interests of, because they know. It's a burden they do not want to commit to. They do not want to commit to that long-term cost because it's unrealistic.
So one last thing, if there's a big instrument out in the sky and taking data, then typically after 2 years they make all the data public, but for 2 years they keep it private. Same with LIGO. Now, could Facebook do the same? Could they say, we sit on our data, but we give you a data dump from 2 years ago that researchers can look at? Is it something that has been discussed? I mean, coming from academia, that would be an obvious answer.
Uh-huh. It's individuals would not want that happen. I would not want that happen in my Facebook data.
Yeah.
What about some kind of aggregated data?
Facebook makes that available already through the public API.
So you kind of think that the kind of closed research that Facebook is doing, mostly trying to find out how to get people addicted more to Facebook, that is okay, but other...
No, I think it's okay. I think it would be great to figure out how users can give and withdraw their consent as they choose to specific research projects. But that implies a lot of costs for Facebook. It's just fine.
Okay, since a January session, I should stop asking questions. Last question, maybe?
Okay. I just wanted to make me mention one thing. So you mentioned low quality academic code, and there are certainly cases where you just want maybe a grad student to solve a very specialized problem with some code, and it's not really a general problem. You know, there's not much point in maintaining that code for many years because it probably won't be used again, even with the best of wills. Now, maybe that's the wrong decision. Maybe you should have got that grad student to program some more sophisticated, more general tool. If it is the case, I know of at least one tool which is designed to work around problems with maintainability. It's called ReproZip. It's about capturing the environment that software lives in kind of a Docker image, something like that, so that you can just capture all the libraries that it depends on and rerun it at any later point in the original condition. So it should still at least work in the future, even if it wouldn't work on your normal software environment. So I think that's a nice tool to have out there. So in that case, just putting the cracky code up on the internet is worth something. Because if you also do this,
yeah.
Actually, the environment it lives in, then it's still useful.